Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, Robert, and good to see everyone. So I came down from Michigan City, Indiana. I don't know how many of you have been to Northwest Indiana recently, but if you want to see a good glimpse of what's happening outside of, say, the south side or west side of Chicago, I suggest taking a South Shore trip from Millennium Station to either South Bend or Michigan City. So the reason why I mention that is because a lot of what I'm going to say today is colored by the fact that I grew up in that area. So I originally was born and raised in the 10th Ward, Eddie Verdoliak's area, Fast Eddie, for those who know. Family was all union iron workers, veterans, and so on. Worked in the steel mills, building bridges, railroads. So I grew up in an area in the 90s, as we're finding out now, at least the younger generation, just how violent the 90s were in this city throughout that period, and particularly in those areas. So my family was part of that white flight that left the city in the mid-1990s, and then I ended up in Chesterton, Indiana, which, for those of you who might not know, is a town of about 11,000 people and about 96% white. So my lunches on the southeast side in the 10th Ward were bilingual lunches, and then by the time I hit fifth grade and I'm in Chesterton, Indiana, it looks like Eddie Munster or Haskell, what's his name? Eddie Haskell, I'm sorry, not Eddie Munster. Yeah, it's like Leave It to Beaver land. It's picket fences and so on and so on. So in that context, you know, I went to grade school, went to middle school and high school in Chesterton. Wasn't academically interested at all. My parents were not radicals. They voted Democrat. My dad was a union guy, was a union iron worker, so on and so on. You know, there was no radicalization or political activism a part of my everyday life. So I didn't grow up with that. I didn't grow up going to campaigns or rallies or so on. I joined the Marine Corps as a senior in high school, and speaking of the Cubs playing today, a big part of it had to do with the fact that I wanted to play baseball in college. Broke my wrist senior year of high school, couldn't go to college to play ball, figured what the hell else am I going to do? Do I want to work in a steel mill? No. Do I want to work at McDonald's? No. Join the Marine Corps, which still, 10 years later, might have been the best option of the three, as sick as that is. That being said, that's why I joined, so we could get past that question right now. Why did you join? That was the biggest reason why. Wasn't academically interested, didn't feel like working another bullshit working class blue-collar job that I watched my dad and all of his friends break their fucking backs, end up in the hospital, end up falling off a scaffolding, blowtorching their arms, losing their fingers because they were putting up skyscrapers in this city. Didn't want to do any of that. Ended up in the Marine Corps. And, you know, let's back up for a second, too. I mean, let's be serious here. I was a kid who was, I was born in 1984. So for me, being a kid was like, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone, Rambo, Chuck Norris, and the whole bit. It was a very militarized culture that we were growing up in. Playing cops and robbers, playing army, watching cops on TV. This was the context. And it wasn't out of the ordinary. Pretty much every one of my friends, everywhere we went, at any time, were doing the same things, watching the same movies, playing the same video games, and so on. So it wasn't out of the ordinary for a working class white kid from this area to join the Marine Corps. Joined the infantry, ended up being sent to Iraq during the initial invasion. Wasn't asking too many questions at that time. Just kind of in that structure of following orders, being with my friends and so on, getting ready to go to Baghdad. Was sent home early from my first deployment on a Red Cross message because my mother had a brain aneurysm. So I flew from Iraq to Kuwait, Kuwait to Chicago, was in Northwestern University waiting for my mom's brain surgery to finish. Once that finished, took care of her for a couple months, went back to the Marine Corps where I was stationed in 29 Palms, California. Trained for another 8 or 9 months, and then ended up in Iraq a second time. And during my second deployment, we were in Al-Qaim, which is in the Al-Anbar region, about 5 miles east of the Syrian border, right on the Euphrates. For those of you who have been following the last few years, of course, this is a Sunni area. This is an area that at the time was extremely violent and right now and was the first area controlled by ISIS, remains controlled by ISIS to this day. To make a long story short, and because I've talked about this in the past, and this isn't the topic for tonight's discussion, a lot of brutal things took place during that deployment. A lot of innocent people were killed, people were torturing people, U.S. soldiers and Marines were mutilating dead bodies, taking pictures with dead bodies, shooting at innocent civilians, and the list goes on and on and on. I testified to Congress about these things in 2008, and I've been speaking out about them publicly for the last 10 years. And as I mentioned, that's not the topic for today's conversation, but I want to lay sort of some of the groundwork of where I come from, what my experiences were, and how they've sort of shaped me and gotten me to the point where I'm at today, and why I'm doing the work that I'm doing today. And so after returning home, well, I should back up actually. Prior to that second deployment, a friend of mine from the platoon is a Southern Baptist kid from Eastern Kentucky. It took me to the San Diego movie theater 7 days prior to my second deployment to see Michael Moore's film, Fahrenheit 9/11. So after I watched that film, somebody's laughing up here in the front. After I watched that film, as a 20-year-old kid, very confused about my first deployment, very confused about what we were about to go do, that movie helped shape the way that I think, approached my next deployment. And it helped me start asking questions, forced me to start looking at the war from a different angle. And that was really, from that point on, I was sort of utterly critical of what was happening. Got in a lot of trouble in Iraq for asking questions, was put on duty stations where my life was at risk, that was on purpose, was filling sandbags in places while we were getting mortared, that was on purpose, and we could go on down the list. Luckily, I made it, so they couldn't kill my ass, so it's good to be here now. But those are the experiences that shaped some of my politicization at that time, radicalization that was taking place. That wasn't overtly political. I mean, when people ask me, you know, why did you shift? How did you change? A lot of it was, you know, reading people like Hunter S. Thompson. It wasn't reading Marx. It was taking LSD. It was hanging out with friends. It was smoking pot, drinking booze, hanging out with people, talking to them, having long conversations. It wasn't this sort of highly intellectualized, nothing wrong with that. That's not the way that as a young veteran, as someone who was asking questions, I was politicized. And I think that's something to keep in mind, because if we're bringing people into these spaces, such as a space like today, and expecting, like here today, I know it's mostly leftists in the crowd, people who I self-identify as radicals and so on. If we're interested in bringing other people into the mix, I think it's important to keep that in mind, that it's not necessarily lectures, it's not these sort of, I don't know, I don't want to call my own presentation boring, but you know, it's not these kind of events, I guess, that are going to get people excited, people who haven't been involved. We have to approach people on that cultural level. We have to make some of this fun. I think we forget that. And especially in a room like today, where the demographic is a little older, you know, I can imagine. I mean, I'm pretty cynical, and I'm 32 years old. So I can imagine the people in this room, there's a level of cynicism that I probably can't quite comprehend yet. That being said, you know, if we are interested in bringing people into the mix, and this gets to the point of this conversation here today, building effective social movements, yeah, I think we have to realize some of that. We have to, you know, yeah, nobody's saying, hey, look, don't be cynical, hey, don't be critical, or, you know, sometimes feel like you're apathetic or nihilistic about some of these things. But to understand that if we are interested in bringing new people into the mix, you know, they want to come into a room full of vibrant people, full of people who are going to ask them questions, talk to them, have conversations. They're going to come into a room and not feel welcome or feel like, hey, no one here wants to talk about anything, or, hey, the guy in the back of the room just told me that none of this matters anyway. I'm sorry, but it's going to be very hard to keep them engaged and to keep them further engaged in any kind of future movements. So I'm going to get to some of that. I just wanted to lay that groundwork Some of the stuff that I'll mention here, I think a lot of people will know. But a few people sent me messages prior to the event today, and they said, "What do you mean we're losing?" Now, I couldn't believe that. But there were people who sent me messages who were like, "I really don't know what you're talking about. How do you calibrate whether or not we're losing or not?" So I'm going to go through a quick list and three sort of specific venue or avenues that we're going to take here. The first will be U.S. Empire. The second will be a breakdown of American society. And the third, and really a global society, but we'll talk about American society. We could get into the global society in Q&A. And then the third and most important in my vision, or in my view, is ecological crisis. Our generation of activists faces a timeline. And this is much different than what your generation faced. This is much different than what previous generations faced. We have a clock, and it's ticking, and time is running out, and we're losing. We've got about a few decades to drastically change the situation, or as my good friend says, you might as well light up some joints, crack some beers, and go to the beach because it's not going to matter. That's the situation that we're in right now. For people in the room who've already come to the conclusion that, hey, we're and it's over with, well, I can understand that perspective. However, the perspective that I'm going to give you today is that part of me feels that way, sure, but as our friend Kim Sipes here reminds us, whether or not you think that's the case, if we don't struggle, if we don't resist, it's guaranteed. That much we know. So we can't guarantee that if you do resist, and if you're engaged and so on, and we continue these movements, that people are going to be successful. That we don't know. But we do know that if we don't engage, if we don't volunteer, if we don't put our times towards building serious resistance movements to stop the murder of the planet, then yes, we are indeed f***ed. And I don't think anyone in this room would question that, and I hope by the first part of this presentation we could put that to rest. The point, though, isn't to harp on the fact that we're in serious trouble. It's to recognize the very serious and very specific historical context that we're living in today. And the challenges that we face, while some of them are very similar to previous challenges, are also very unique to the time in which we live. So when it comes to U.S. Empire, I don't think we really need to go down the list. I'm pretty sure everyone here is pretty familiar with Obama's foreign policy disasters, of course, starting in Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, Libya, Egypt, Syria, Yemen, Ukraine, and the list goes on. That's just in terms of occupation, coups, drone strikes, and so on. We also have, of course, the drone program, estimations of upwards of 4,000 people killed by Obama's drone program, the massive surveillance state, Obama's war on whistleblowers, Cold War 2.0 with Russia, and a whole list of atrocities and brutalities that have been continued from the Bush era into the Obama era over the last 8 years. Now, I don't say that with any pleasure, because as someone who came up through the anti-war movement, it is really a great shame, and it's really sad that we no longer have an anti-war movement in the United States. And I'm sorry, but I would also argue that we maybe never had, at least in my time, an objectively principled anti-war movement. What I came to find from the time I was involved from 2006 to 2008 with the anti-war movement was that it was largely an anti-GOP movement. It was anti-Bush. It wasn't that we were principally against the United States empire, or that we were principally positioned against U.S. exceptionalism, or that we were opposed to the CIA coups, or so on and so forth, a structural systemic critique that didn't really exist. The majority of the money, the funds, and so on came from sources that were simply interested in demonizing Bush and demonizing the Republicans while giving the Democrats and Obama sort of a clean sheet. And we've seen what the result of that has been. I mean, literally the movements that I worked with for 2 or 3 years of my life, devoting my time from 22 years old to 25 years old, they disintegrated and disappeared almost overnight in 2008 and 2009. I'm going to get back to some of that as well, but I just want to reiterate my own experience here. So the military historian Nick Turse recently wrote, quote, last year, according to AFRICOM Commander General David Rodriguez, the U.S. military carried out a total of 546 activities on the African continent. Activities is a catch-all term for everything the U.S. military does in Africa. In other words, it averages about 1.5 missions per day on the continent. This represents a 217% increase in operations, programs, and exercises since the command was established in 2008. That's a 217% increase in U.S. military operations in Africa since Obama has been in office. This is a continent that even those who have been very critical of U.S. militarism haven't focused much of their time on. Most of our time, even those who've remained critical, have been focused on Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, and Libya, to some degree Egypt. As Terse goes on to mention, these exercises include, quote, airstrikes targeting suspected militants, night raids aimed at kidnapping terror suspects, airlifts of French and African troops onto the battlefields of proxy wars, and evacuation operations in destabilized countries. Above all, however, the U.S. military conducts training missions, mentors allies, and funds, equips, and advises its local surrogates. The 18 nations who will be assisting the U.S. AFRICOM Command in further military exercises and operations include the UK, France, the Netherlands, Norway, Denmark, those beautiful Nordic countries, Italy, and Germany, among others. And again, this is really important to keep in mind. Of course, we're focusing on U.S. militarism, imperialism, U.S. empire. But it's not just the U.S. empire who benefits from U.S. imperialism. So if you look at a lot of the contracts that are taking place in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's not in the traditional way simply benefiting U.S. corporations or the U.S. state. As a matter of fact, the majority of large contracts, especially for rare earth mineral extraction in Afghanistan, have gone for Chinese corporations. The same is true in Iraq, but for Japanese corporations. In some ways, the changing coordinates of the geopolitical framework in the world sort of dictate that the United States is the global military force for capitalism, not so much just for the U.S. empire or for the U.S. nation state. Indeed, capitalist countries such as those I just mentioned from Europe, highly advanced, highly developed nations, are benefiting from U.S. imperialism in Africa, but so are developing nations, such as India and China, whose corporations are benefiting from contracts in Afghanistan and Iraq. So let's be clear, it's not just the U.S., though America is the most belligerent of the bunch, no doubt, who is militarizing. As Shanai Shankar writes in International Business Times Online, quote, India imported more than twice as many weapons in the past 5 years than it did in the previous five-year span ending in 2009, making it the world's largest buyer of arms currently. Additionally, Shankar notes, quote, Russia, which reached an initial agreement last month with Egypt for a $2 billion arms deal, accounted for 75% of the arms supplied to India, while the United States supplied a mere 7%. China, being the second largest importer of arms in the world today, has also become a major supplier of arms in South Asia, accounting for 54% of Pakistan's arms imports and 82% of the arms imports in Bangladesh. In the last 5 years, Australia's arms imports have also increased by 83%. In short, the world is militarizing. This is, I think, a really important point that Noam Chomsky made after 9/11. It was a point that I think fell on mute ears at the time because people were so freaked out about what was happening. But the point that Chomsky made was that every state apparatus in the world was going to use 9/11 as an excuse to crack down on their own citizens, their own activists, their own revolutionaries, and also to militarize. More than 15 years later, we see this sort of on a perfect scale. So right now, as we speak, there are also over 30 nations developing drone technology. Now, drones, in my opinion, sort of mark a turning point in the way that we're fighting wars. I think everybody recognizes that when we're using machines with people holed up at a military base in Nevada, eating Cheetos and eating a cheeseburger while launching drone strikes on people in Iraq, significantly changes the landscape of the ways in which we understand wars being fought and the ways that wars are being fought themselves, technically. So right now, as I mentioned, there are 30 other nations that are developing drone technology. This is much like the nuclear weapon in this way. This has started an arms race among nation states where almost every nation in the world now, at least if they're not already building them, are interested in building and using drones. Peter Singer, not the philosopher, but a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute and one of the leading experts on drone technology, I suggest reading his book. I think his book's called Wired for War. Talks about autonomous military weapon systems. This is the future of warfare. And as Singer says, he makes an important point when he says, quote, "We're not talking about the how of fighting future wars. That was nuclear weapons. How are we going to fight them? A new weapon here. What we're talking about now is who is going to be fighting wars. And the who in the future will be a combination of human beings and computers, most notably autonomous military robotics technology defense by mostly advanced and developed by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. So recently there was a study prepared by the U.S. Joint Forces Command, which suggests that by 2025, that's 9 years from now, the U.S. military will have the technology to develop autonomous battlefield robots. Now, we're not talking about drones that take commands from someone sitting in another command center. What we're talking about now in the future, in my lifetime, I'm 32 years old now, so by 2025, I'll be 42 years old, or 41 years old. By the time I'm 41 years old, it is projected that we will have the technology available and the military weapons and capacity available to deploy autonomous battlefield robots. That means that machines will be making the decision whether or not to kill. There won't be someone sitting behind a joystick. This will, of course, be advanced by developments in artificial technology, nanotechnology, biotech, and so on. So even Stephen Hawking has reflected on the future of artificial intelligence, and I don't use these particular sources for any reason other than for the conservatives who might be watching or the liberals who might be watching, who are going to ask, who are these crazy sources? I'll use sort of the most standard mainstream sources I can. Stephen Hawking, reflecting on the future of artificial intelligence, this was in an article in The Independent late last year. Quote, "In the near term, world militaries are considering autonomous weapons systems that can choose and eliminate targets. The UN and Human Rights Watch have advocated a treaty banning such weapons. In the medium term, as emphasized by Eric Bjornson and Andrew McAfee in The Second Machine Age, artificial intelligence may transform our economy to bring both great wealth and great dislocation. One can imagine such technology outsmarting financial markets, out-inventing human researchers, out-manipulating human leaders, and developing weapons that we human beings cannot even begin to understand. Whereas the short-term impact of artificial intelligence depends on who controls it, the long-term impact depends on whether or not it can be controlled at all." The point here, for regular folks, for people who are involved in building movements and so on, is that this trend either is going to be stopped immediately, and as Hawking mentions, treaties put in place, movements put in place, people, of course, in my opinion, if we don't control at least elements of the state apparatus, then I don't see how the U.S. military, the empire, people within research and development, R&D community, just going to stop on their own. And of course, we know that the United States isn't going to just follow international treaties. So we're going to need an international movement that's capable of stopping these kinds of weapons technology advancements, because this is literally the future of what warfare looks like. So I'm pretty sure everyone here understands the sort of horror show that is domestic American society. From poverty and violence to suicides and drug addiction, the U.S. is a decaying society by most standards. When my friends come and visit from overseas, they are literally blown away. When I take them for walks around Chicago, when I take them to events in Northwest Indiana, they can't believe not only the level of poverty, they can't believe the levels of inequality, and they cannot believe the levels of violence that are taking place here. It is unimaginable and incomprehensible to most people, not only who live in the industrialized world, but even many people who live in developing world, around the world. So according to financial advisory firm Deloitte, income inequality in the U.S. is currently the highest it's been since the 1920s. I don't think that surprises anyone here, but just to run through some of the stats, with 400 American billionaires owning more wealth than 155 million Americans combined, all of this while a third to one half of Americans live in poverty, depending on what sort of barometers one uses, and another third can barely make ends meet. Microsoft founder Bill Gates leads the list of America's wealthiest with a net worth of $66 billion. What's wild, of course, is that Deloitte's analysis predicts, based on current trends, that U.S. millionaires will see a 225% increase in their wealth by 2020. Accounting for wealth hidden in offshore accounts, they are projected to have over $100 trillion, with a T, in total within the next decade. So it's no surprise then that according to a recent Wall Street Journal, quote, over 94% of American millionaires are scared of riots in the streets, unquote. Among industrialized nations, the United States enjoys the highest poverty rate, both generally and for children, the greatest inequality of incomes, the lowest government spending as a percentage of GDP on social programs for the disadvantaged, the lowest number of days of paid holiday, annual leaves, and maternity leaves, the lowest social mobility rate, although now we're the second lowest social mobility rate, right next to England, highest infant mortality rate, the highest prevalence of mental health problems, the highest obesity rate, and the highest consumption of antidepressants per capita. These trends are accompanied by the third shortest life expectancy at birth, the largest international arms sales, the third lowest scores for student performance in math and science, the second highest high school dropout rate, the highest homicide rate, and the largest prison population in the world. Canadian sociologist Morris Berman, in his book Dark Ages America, notes that, quote, and I think this is very important when we're talking about the alienation of American society, by 2003, that's 2003, mind you, before the Great Recession, the number of Americans who attended even one public meeting at town or school affairs during the previous year was down 40% from what it had been 20 years prior. Additionally, Berman observes that in the mid-1970s, Americans entertained friends at their home on an average of 14 to 15 times per year. By 2006, that number had dropped 50%. While in 2003, 73% of Americans, 73%, stated that most people, including their neighbors, could not be trusted. In 1964, the same survey found that 77% of people interviewed said that their fellow citizens could indeed be trusted. Today, the United States represents 5% of the world's population, yet consumes 50% of the world's pharmaceuticals and 80% of the world's prescription narcotics. Let me say that again. The United States represents 5% of the world's population, yet it consumes 50% of the world's pharmaceuticals and 80% of the world's prescription narcotics. In a county no less than an hour from here, a neighboring county of mine in Indiana, according to the Mental Health and Recovery Services Board, from 2006 to 2014, clients who sought treatment for opium abuse increased 210%. I know at least a handful of people who have died from heroin overdoses. My brother, who's 4 years younger than I, knows maybe a dozen to a dozen and a half people who have died from heroin overdoses. I say those things again because when we talk about American society collapsing, it's not just, oh, there's tons of income inequality. Oh, people can't find jobs. Oh, the education system. No, literally the fabric of life. Our ability to hang out with one another, our ability to view our neighbors as citizens and people, friends, potential comrades, people we might want to spend time with and organize or do something important with, is affected not only by the inequality and so on, but by these sort of cultural phenomena as well, this hyper-alienation as a result of extreme individualism, extreme materialism, hyper-consumption, and so on. This is a big part of it. And I think this is really important for people to keep in mind when we're talking about organizing. Because we're not talking about organizing the same community or the same society that we were organizing 10, 15, 20, 40, 50 years ago. There have been major changes. Of course, many of those changes have been negative, but I think it's important to keep that in mind. And that level of alienation, I think, might be one of our biggest challenges. I've listened to previous OUL events, and I have friends who've come and given presentations here, people like Kim and Paul Street. One of the things that I'm running into or that I'm encountering is that it's no longer that people don't know that things are screwed up. It's quite the opposite. Majority of people my age or younger that I'm encountering and have encountered for the last 10 years of doing work understand fully that things are screwed up. It's getting them to buy into the idea that they have the power to actually do something about it. Because for years as an activist, I heard people say, oh, Americans are brainwashed morons. They're never going to get it. Don't bother. They're highly propagandized people, and it's never going to happen. And I must say, a lot of my own personal experience of being an activist, it reflected those suggestions. And when we were organizing in 2006, 2007, 2008, people would tell us, it's not that bad, or trying to explain to people that the surge wasn't going to work, that there would be massive blowback from these wars. At the time, people really didn't want to hear it. In the post-2008 world, there's been a much different response. The response now from most of my friends and family and the people we're running into in the streets, knocking on doors, going to events, holding campaigns, and so on, is we're f***ed, and there's nothing we can do about it, so why even bother? That's generally the attitude. So if, again, we probably bring this up more and more as the day goes on here, or as the presentation goes on, but if that's your conclusion, that's fine, but for people who are still interested in organizing, and I'll talk about this after I talk about these ecological statistics and this ecological framework, this framework of ecological collapse, is even in that context, so even if you come to the conclusion that environmentally we can't do much more, and that yes, we've already sort of sealed in certain ecological barometers that will guarantee that 50 to 100 years from now will be a living hell on this planet. From now until then, there will be several things that happen. People will still be living. Communities will still exist. So the point I've been making to people who are saying, well, hey, we're already screwed. All of this is already sealed in fate, so on and so on, is even in the context of collapse, you're going to need cooperation. You're going to need communities. You're going to need to work together, whether that be on a neighborhood level, on the level of your apartment complex, on the level of the block that you live in. If anyone in this room hasn't spent time in failed states, I suggest you do. Because even in failed states, people have to organize. And it's not going to be like this is overnight. It's not going to be one day everybody wakes up, eats a Snickers bar, watches some Netflix, smokes a pot, and goes to sleep, and then the next day there's nothing. It's going to be slow decline as it's been for many decades here, unless things can be turned around. So it's not going to be, all of a sudden 2025, nobody has water. It's going to be, 2025, we've got 30 million, 40 million refugees from Louisiana, from Mississippi, and Florida who've got to be relocated. How's that going to happen? What are we going to do? Put them in internment camps? You think white people in the South are going to be excited to take a bunch of Hispanic and black people from Louisiana and Florida who are going to be refugees? And according to this climate scientist, that's exactly who's going to be the refugees first in this country? No. Those things are going to need to be worked out, and they're going to need to be worked out in a serious fashion over the next 50 years. So talking about the environment, this is not the most positive part of the talk. Oh, you got somebody back there. Some recent reports. I don't even need to read all the details. I'll just skim through this, and then we'll get into some of the discussion. I'll get in a little bit of my background, some of the movements I've been working with, and some ideas. So the World Wildlife Fund reports that, quote, between 1970 and 2010, populations of mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, and fish around the globe dropped by 52%. That's between 1970 and 2010, we've lost 52% of the mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, and fish around the globe. The biodiversity loss occurs disproportionately in low-income countries and correlates with the increasing resource use of high-income countries. Similarly, a recent headline in Live Science reads, "Most of the world's biggest mammals could be extinct by 2100. A recent story in National Geographic paints an even worse picture for the world's oceans. Quote, "Unless humans act now, seafood may disappear by 2048, concludes the lead author of a new study that paints a more than grim picture for the ocean and human health. The loss of ocean biodiversity is accelerating. 29% of the seafood species humans consume have already crashed. If the long-term trends continue, in 30 years, there will be little to no seafood available for sustainable harvest," unquote. Interestingly, the military is way ahead of the civilian state apparatus when it comes to climate change. A recent Guardian headline from 2 days ago reads, quote, "Military experts say climate change poses the most significant risk to security around the globe. A coalition of 25 prominent members of U.S. national state security community warn that higher temperatures and rising seas will inundate bases," because we have over 1,500 military bases, including in the United States, around the world, "and fuel conflict, not to mention massive migrations on a level unprecedented in human history." Dar Jamail, also, in my opinion, one of the best reporters out there. I consider him a friend and someone that I think everyone should pay attention to his work. So Dar Jamail, reporting at Truthout, recently spoke to Dr. Peter Wadhams. That's W-A-D-H-A-M-S. I suggest checking out his work as well. So Dr. Wadhams suggests that Arctic sea ice could completely disappear in the next 2 years. This would be the first time in more than 10,000 years that Arctic sea ice has completely disappeared. The immediate consequences, according to Wadhams and Dar Jamail, includes, quote, "The loss from the shallow shelf areas north of Siberia is dangerous. Why? Because it encourages emissions of methane from the seabed as an offshore permafrost melts. Secondly, the loss from Baffin Bay and East Greenland in summer encourages warm winds over the Greenland ice sheet, which cause ice sheet melt and accelerated sea level rise." Recent headlines highlight Wadhams' warnings. Another Guardian article notes, quote, "A new study partly sponsored by NASA's Space Goddard Flight Center has highlighted the prospect that global industrial civilization could collapse in coming decades due to unsustainable resource exploitation and increasingly unequal wealth distribution." Even more conservative climate activists, such as Bill McKibben, routinely recognize that the severity of the situation increases with each passing moment. So this is an article published just 2 days ago in the New Republic. Bill McKibben writes, quote, "The future of humanity depends on math, and the numbers in the new study released Thursday are the most ominous yet. Those numbers spell out, in simple arithmetic, how much of the fossil fuel in the world's existing coal mines and oil wells we can burn if we want to prevent global warming from cooking the planet. In other words, if our goal is to keep the Earth's temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius, the upper limit identified by the nations and scientists of the world, how much more digging and drilling can we do today? Well, here's the answer. Zero. Absolutely none." That's right. To continue to quote McKibben, "If we're serious about preventing catastrophic warming, the new study shows we can't dig any new coal mines, drill any new fields, build any more pipelines, not a single one. We're done expanding the fossil fuel frontier. Our only hope is a swift, managed decline in the production of all carbon-based energy from the fields we've already put into production." The reason I point that out and the reason I use McKibben is because in the people that I'm reading and the climate scientists that I'm checking out, McKibben actually falls more on the conservative end. But the important point, and the point that McKibben makes throughout the article, is that we should be facing and we should be preparing to face the absolute worst. Because year after year after year, each new study that comes out is worse than the one that came out before it. So when there's a new study that comes out next month that says, you know what, we studied these numbers for 2 decades, and my God, it's just this much worse than we thought it was going to be. That has been the trend for 25 years of climate science. So McKibben's point, my point, people like Guy McPherson's point, people like Derek Jensen who are making this point as well, is that we should be preparing for the absolute worst, and we should be resisting as though our lives depend on it. Now, to end this section on climate, I want to quote Anne and Paul Ehrlich. These are great biologists from Australia I've had the chance of meeting. They've been doing great work for many, many decades now. And the point they're making, again, highlights part of what I mentioned earlier, and that's that our generation of activists, this new generation of people who are coming up, are facing a context that is in many ways quite unprecedented. So according to the Ehrlichs, Australian Biologies, this in the peer-reviewed journal Proceedings of a Royal Society, quote, virtually every past civilization has eventually undergone collapse, a loss of socio-political economic complexity usually accompanied by a dramatic decline in population size. Some, such as civilizations in Egypt and China, have recovered from collapses at various stages. Others, such as that of the Easter Island or the classic Maya, were apparently permanent. All those previous collapses were local or regional. Somewhere elsewhere, other societies and civilizations persisted unaffected. Sometimes, as in the Tigris and Euphrates valleys, new civilizations arose in succession. In many, if not most cases, overexploitation of the environment was one proximate or ultimate cause of collapse. But today, for the first time in humanity's history, human global civilization, the worldwide, increasingly interconnected, highly technological society in which we are all one degree or another embedded, is threatened with collapse by an array of environmental problems. The reason I end with that quote is because today people are focusing on climate change. And yes, as others have argued, climate change may very well pose the most significant existential threat. But it is not just climate change. And it is not just making a transition to green technology. And this is where we get into talking about activism. This is where we get into talking about what is it exactly that we should do. Because when we talk about switching from a fossil fuel-based industry to a green technology, or however people want to say this, renewable energy systems, here I would quote my friend Derek, who would say, any way of life based on the use of non-renewable energy is doomed to failure. That much is pretty obvious to understand. But also, any way of life that is based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable energy is also doomed to fail. So this idea that we're just going to live within a capitalist system, everything's going to be fine, we'll continue all these same structures and so on, but we'll just switch from using coal and natural gas and nuclear energy and petrol products to using solar and wind and so on is false. And I think many new people who are involved, including many of the younger environmental activists that I'm speaking with, I think really understand this. They want a more nuanced discussion about what that kind of a just transition would look like, how many resources can we use. As Kim and I have talked about in the past, what standard of living could what will be 9 billion people who are living on this planet by 2050 live at that would be sustainable? Because obviously, living in the United States, where we have 5% of the world's population, but we use 33% of the world's resources, isn't going to cut it. And it isn't going to cut it talking about the environment, just talking about climate change, and not talking about deforestation, overfishing, the use of plastics, where we dump this material, production lines, supply chains, and so on. And we can go on down the list, rivers being polluted, waterways being polluted, so on and so forth. But the conversation, in my opinion, becomes much more interesting when we broaden it out. And we say, no, it's not just climate change, and no, it's not just running our economy on fossil fuels, because only what the numbers are, it's like 55 to 60% of the petrol that is extracted is used actually to run engines. The other 40 to 45% of the petrol that's extracted is used for different plastics So your car, for instance, your car tires, everything that's in this room, this table, anything that's polyester, so on and so forth. So the everything you look at in this room is a great example that's made out of a plastic material comes from that level of extraction. So it's not just so much, you know, people, and of course I agree, you want to abolish capitalism, that's fine. I'm for it. I was for it 10 years ago. I'm still for it. I also think part of the issue is industrialization. And if you speak with indigenous activists, if you speak, and I've had a great opportunity to work with Aboriginal activists in Australia, I've had a great opportunity to work with Native American activists here. The biggest difference I can find from traditional leftists who come from a traditional left background, anarchist, communist, Marxist, socialist, and so on, is a completely different view in terms of the living world that I get from indigenous activists. And if you listen to the lectures, if you read the histories, if you look at the material that's being produced now from the activists in places like North Dakota or South Dakota, it is a different view of the natural world. It's not a natural world that can be managed, a natural world that can be sort of shifted to human needs, used when humans want it, discarded when humans want to, shit on when humans want to, protected when humans want to protect it. But it's looking at the natural world as a partner in our existence. And this gets much deeper than just, hey, how do we come up with some policies and some laws that can fix this? No, this is going to require people to radically change the ways in which they view themselves within this context and the ways in which they view the natural world. And one of the most important things we need to do is to talk about this idea of human supremacism, this idea that human beings are the most important species on this planet. Because everything that follows after that allows us, it's a justification for everything we want to do. If human beings are the most important people on the planet, well, anything we need to do to the rivers to make sure that human beings can live in the short term, that's fine. Anything we can do to the forests to make sure that human beings can live in the short term, that's fine too. This is some of the more important, I think, conversations, debates, and so on that we should be having if we're going to talk about ecology, if we're going to talk about living on a living planet in the future. And then, as I mentioned before, the question most of my friends are asking is not so much, it's interesting, I hear people talk about revolution, and again, that's great, I'm for it, I've been for it, I think we should be building movements that are capable of doing that. But within this context of collapse, a lot of the activists I'm speaking with as well, and a good friend of mine, Samantha Castro, is going to be in town from Australia next week. She heads the Friends of the Earth office in Melbourne, Australia. Probably the most radical NGO that's out there, in my opinion, at least environmental NGO. A lot of the NGOs in the environmental side is so. This is a great one in Australia. Part of what she's been talking about with a lot of the communities they're organizing with is how to brace for impact. So it's no longer, oh, we've got, because I hear people talking like, we'll build the Green Party. And how long is that going to take? Oh, 10, 20 years. Oh, well, according to the data, in 20 years, we're not going to have f***ing fish in the ocean. So in 20 years, if Jill Stein or her predecessor or whatever, her successor, I'm sorry, becomes a viable candidate for president, that's great. But at the same time, we won't have fish in the ocean. So that means two things. That means either one, we build a movement big enough to do both, which means to build electoral capacity. We don't have the numbers for that. But to build the electoral capacity necessary to get people elected or to have a new political party while simultaneously having enough momentum and numbers to direct action, civil disobedience, protests, educational events, and so on. Of course, in my opinion, all of this should be part of one program, but we don't have the numbers for that. So when Samantha in Australia was asking me, what do you think about what's going on in North Dakota? I said, it's awesome. I mean, how could anyone in their right mind who's sitting in this room say, you know, sort of poo-poo that and say, oh my, yeah, it's just nonsense or whatever. It's great. And we should use those lessons. We should use that information to help build new campaigns, coalitions, and so on. But it also is a sign of our limitations. That is quite literally where we are at. The ability to stop one segment of one small project. That is where we're at. We could stop the Keystone and simultaneously there's 15 other pipelines that go in at the same time. We can stop North Dakota, but at the same time, Obama okayed offshore drilling in the Atlantic, they're going to drill in the Arctic, and so on and so forth. Now, is this to bash all of the people who are involved? The answer is no. I give all of them, myself and everyone in this room, a ton of credit for staying involved, for being out there, for speaking out and being courageous. That's not the point. The point for me is, again, getting to the point of this conversation and the conversation I hope to have with you when I end here, is how can we build more effective movements? How can we take those lessons and expand them out? How can we build a movement that would be simultaneously capable of stopping a pipeline being put in North Dakota, but also run congressional candidates, but also be involved in, say, maybe more revolutionary behavior? Because, to be honest with you folks, and I say this as someone whose life has been virtually destroyed by violence, and I've seen violence destroy people's lives for the last 14 years of my life, since I was 18 years old. But I'm not a pacifist. I'm not a nonviolent dogmatist. In my opinion, as soon as I left the Marine Corps in 2006, I said, yeah, these people, they're willing to kill anybody in the world to get exactly what they want. And in order to stop entities like that, am I prescribing martyrdom to people? No, but I'm sorry, in my lifetime, people are going to die. We're facing the most powerful entities in the world. These oil companies are willing to kill all of us. They have known about climate change for the last 40 years and used the same PR companies that the tobacco industry used to try and misinform people for the last 40 years. They don't care. So this idea that, a few marches, a few votes, people will get arrested, my God, people might get beat up by the cops. Yeah, all that's already happening. My assumption is in the future, we're going to need to build movements where people are willing to put their lives on the line, literally willing to put their lives on the line, to not only defend themselves and their communities, but to defend the planet. Now, that's not a prescription for a bunch of lunatics running around with AK-47s and so on. What that is, though, is a suggestion that anyone who's interested in building a resistance movement needs to talk about what that resistance movement actually looks like to combat the most powerful military, empire, industrial complex the world has ever seen. And obviously we know this. Someone like Martin Luther King called the United States the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. This was 40 years ago, 45 years ago. In 45 years, it's become only that much more brutal, that much more violent, and that much more powerful in some ways. So, some people think that that's really depressing. I don't. I mean, honestly, a lot of us, we've come to this conclusion a long time ago. I mean, a lot of us, I think, are looking at the situation saying, okay, we can continue to do what we're doing and resist and pat each other on the back and go to these events and set up fundraisers and so on, and we could all just make ourselves feel good until it's over with. Or we can take a step back, look at what we're doing, and come to the conclusion that it's not working. We've had an environmental movement for 45 years in this country. 45 years since the beginning of the environmental movement in this country. And I'm sorry, folks, every single ecological indicator is worse today than it was 45 years ago. We've had the beginnings of a vibrant anti-war movement 45 years ago. And I'm sorry, folks, but the empire is that much bigger than it has ever been. So that, again, isn't to just, hey, well, that's it, let's go home. In my thinking, what I'm interested to do, why I'm here today, why Robert asked me to come here, is to have a conversation about why that is, number one, and number two, what could we do to fix that? And if there is no, again, I'm not trying to say there's a solution, that there's easy answers. I'm looking for suggestions from people. I think we should all be looking for suggestions from one another. And I think we should also be really nice to one another, because I spent 2.5 years when I did a radio podcast out of Michigan City, Indiana, interviewing all of my heroes for many, many years. It was like, I have a radio show, my God, how can I start talking to people like Chomsky or Judith Butler or Cornel West or Vandana Shiva or go on down the list? And I'm here to tell you folks, I don't know if you read all these people's work or pay attention to them, they also don't have many answers. There's a ton of analysis going on the left right now. Robert and I talked about this on the phone. If you look at Truth Out, you look at Common Dreams, you look at Counterpunch, you look at ZNet, go down Black Agenda Report, go down the list. Tons of excellent analysis. Excellent. But in terms of what can we do, what should we do, suggestions for resistance, ideas about the future, visions for what another society would look like, the kind of values we want to base that society on, or what the political program would look like to get to that kind of a society, those conversations are lacking. In fact, they're utterly missing. There's people simply going through the routine saying, hey, we can conduct single-issue campaigns, we can do civil disobedience, we can stop X, Y, or Z projects. But in terms of coming up with a coherent political platform that can be expressed not only through these acts of civil disobedience and single-issue campaigns, but also in an electoral sphere, in an educational context, and so on, that really doesn't exist. And there's a ton of people out there who are going to tell you how bad things are, but we don't have many people out there, and I'm encouraging anyone who's going to watch this, anyone who's going to listen to this, that we need more people writing about what they want. We need more discussions about what it is people want and what to do. Because, as I mentioned before, most average people, I think they're ahead of the curve. I think they're ahead of where average leftists give them credit for. I could talk to my neighbors, and they're not reading Chomsky or Bill McKibben's reports or whatever, and I talk to my neighbors, and they're like, Vince, we're f***ed. So it's not convincing them, oh, your life's bad. No, they know. They're making $7.25 an hour. They don't have health insurance. Their lives are shit. No prospects for the future. They know the environment's getting screwed up. So it's not me sitting there trying to convince my neighbors or people we're knocking on their doors for campaigns that, hey, you know, things are pretty bad. They're looking at me saying, no shit. Tell me something I don't know. And then we say, well, you know, you can get involved with a movement. And then the next response is, well, what good is that going to do? That's up to us. I mean, we have to create the kind of movements and the kind of spaces that people want to come to. It's not going to be, hey, we'll put out the best analysis possible and maybe they'll read it, maybe they won't. And if they don't read it, that's their own fault. They're just another brain-dead, stupid-ass American, and what can we expect from them anyway? No. I think it's up. Nowhere else does that happen. I mean, what I see on the left is sort of a lack of introspection, a lack of reflective capacity. You know, people really don't, it's really hard, and I understand this, because my friends who are full-time organizers, I don't consider myself an organizer, I consider myself an activist. My friends who are organizers, day in, day out, knocking on doors, phone calls, fundraisers, sitting down, meetings, compromises, talking to people they don't want to talk to. I can't do it. I don't have the patience for it. But I pay attention to the people who are doing it, because those are often the people who have really good ideas about what it means to organize, their lessons from organizing, what's working, what's not working. And what they're telling me, from the MTO to the Fight for 15 to the environmental movement to Black Lives Matter, number one, sectarianism is a problem. Number two, identity politics and self-affirmation are a problem. Number three, living in a leftist bubble is a problem. Number four, personalities have been a problem. Number five, and this is getting, I think, to more substantive conversations, a lack of vision, as I mentioned earlier, and also a lack of reflection and an inability to self-critique. When you put all of your energy and effort into a campaign, it's hard to sit back 6 months later and go, you know what, it really wasn't that good. That's tough for anybody here who's done that. For anybody here who's tried to run, not only, I'm not talking about electoral campaigns here, I'm talking about single issue campaigns, like we want to stop this pipeline. If that doesn't work after 6 to 12 months, it's very hard for those organizers and activists to sit back and then say, you know what we were doing, the approach we took, the methods we used, they didn't work. Now how do we get better from this? And having those conversations openly and honestly in public venues such as today, I think personally, is the only way people are going to learn how we can build these movements for the future. So without rambling anymore, because I know it's 4 o'clock, I'm going to leave it there, and I'd rather open it up for Q&A. Thank you.